Daniel, Chapter 12, the 14th talk in a series on Daniel, was presented by David Crabtree on July 19, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 14, Daniel, chapter 12, accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Reformation Fellowship, someplace in cyberspace. We're going to finish up the book of Daniel today. I'm going to respond to, I've got three questions here. I'm going to respond to three questions before I start in on chapter 12, but we will be doing chapter 12, the last chapter of Daniel, this evening. The first question was from Roger. He said, I wonder if verse 33, that's verse 33 of chapter 11. I wonder if verse 33 anticipates the apostles of Jesus and verse 34 anticipates the Pharisees. I'm going to use this opportunity to clarify what I was saying about that section of the chapter. I think that verses 34 and 35 are transitional, and 36 through 39 are transitional. So there are two sections of the transition between talking about Antiochus the IV and what he did and his persecution of the Jews. Then this transitional section is, as I understand it, generic. That is to say, these are the kinds of things that happen, you can expect to happen whenever there is persecution. 34 and 35 are what can believers expect to happen in their midst, that is, among their groups of fellow believers. Then 36 through 39 is talking about persecuting rulers and some generic statements with respect to them. The only thing that gives me pause is with respect to the persecuting rulers, the statement at the end where it makes it sound like they set up feudal systems. I don't know how common that is. And maybe that's more specific. That's the one thing that gives me pause. But otherwise, it looks to me like everything that is said there is the kind of thing that you expect when you have persecuting rulers. So I'm calling it transitional because, and this is something that I've seen elsewhere in prophecy, they'll have a section which in some ways is a continuation of what came before, but in some ways is moving on to another topic. And so in some ways it fits with what follows. We saw that with chapter 7. I think that is a transitional chapter. It's finishing up what Daniel was presenting with respect to the kingdoms for the benefit of Gentile nations, what he wanted to say to them. But it begins the visions that Daniel has, which end up emphasizing the fate of Israel. And so it's transitional in that it shares some features of what preceded it and some features of what followed it. So I think 34 through 39 is similarly transitional. It's talking about speaking generically about what happens in periods of persecution. Then it goes on from 40 to 45, is speaking about another persecutor, an Antiochus-like persecutor, but different from Antiochus. Okay, so that's the way that I'm seeing it. Now, this in the section that this question, in this question came from Roger, in this question, that section is talking about the wise being the ones, as I understand it, the ones who embrace truth, that is, people who are believers. And they are a source of wisdom for many in times of persecution. But they will also be the recipients. They will be targeted in this persecution. And when they are targeted, others will rally around them and provide a little help. And I suspect that means genuinely a little help. But there's a limit on how much help can be provided. But some who are not sincere will join them. In other words, there will be traitors in their midst. So that's what you can expect in a period of persecution. Okay, so Roger's question then is, are the apostles then an example of that? And I think absolutely. They are examples of the wise in this section that that Daniel has here. And then he says, and does 34 anticipate the Pharisees? The way I'm reading it, that would be less so, because the Pharisees would not be pretending to be a part of the party, a part of the people who are supporting the wise. And I was thinking about it, a better example would be Judas. And in fact, Jesus is an example of those of the wise under persecution when he's crucified. And Judas is a great example of the kinds of traitors in their midst that will be true in times of persecution. Second question. I think it was Margaret who asked last week. She asked, when I was talking about the last persecutor, the last persecutor apparently gets scared when he hears news from the east and from the north. And I speculated that the north, I mean, if we look at the political map today, Russia would be a good candidate. East, China would be a good candidate. And Margaret asked, is the United States east or west of Israel? Suggesting that maybe the United States would be a candidate there. And how would you categorize the United States? Is it east of Israel or is it west of Israel? Which is a good question. It's almost halfway in between. In my answer, I said I don't see the United States in prophecy. Now, I haven't figured all of prophecy out. I'm not an expert. I'm not. I don't know enough to say definitively, but it so far in my studies, I don't see the United States as one of the countries that is mentioned in prophecy. Now, there are people that say, well, they're part of the Roman Empire. Maybe, I mean, there's a sense in which we are culturally the descendants of the Roman Empire. We were never territorially part of the Roman Empire. I'm dubious that any of the prophecies that refer to the Roman Empire refer to the United States, even tangentially. I don't think so, but maybe it's possible. Another possibility for a way the United States would figure in is if the United States were closely allied with a Muslim nation. I think there are Muslim nations that will be involved in, that are involved in prophecy. and I'll talk about that more in just a minute. But I think that's unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely. It seems to me that Europe is more likely to become either Muslim or very Muslim friendly as time goes on, because they're going to have a huge population of Muslims before long. And I see no resistance in European culture to the aggressiveness of Muslim culture in Europe. But I don't think, it doesn't seem to me that that's likely to happen in the United States quite like that. So I don't see the United States playing into prophecy by that route either. So then the question that was asked by my wife is, well, how can the United States not be in prophecy? Because the United States is such a big player. And it seems to me that the United States could easily become a non-entity with respect to world politics, a virtual non-entity. I think that the most likely scenario right now, and this is speculation. This isn't prophecy. This isn't, God hasn't spoken to me. I'm just looking out at the world. And as I look out at the world today, the chances of the United States falling into chaos looks to me like it's not at all far-fetched. Some kind of civil war and chaos could easily happen. The fabric of our society is in tatters. And if a virus can shake it, if a flu virus can shake it, it's precarious. So I don't think it's at all far-fetched to see the United States just internally kind of falling apart and either hot or cold civil war breaking into sections and who knows what all. But it seems to me that that's very, very possible. And if that were to happen, then the United States, there's no reason the United States would show up in prophecy, because it's not really a key player anymore. I got another question from Robbie. She said, I'm wondering why you think Iran is the kingdom of the north and not Turkey. Wasn't Turkey also under Seleucid rule? And she says, I must admit that I was surprised to see you named names at all. Naming names is risky, but I'm a risk taker. The Seleucid Empire, you could Google the Seleucid Empire and it'll show you a map of the area that it encompassed at its height. And it did encompass, it was Iran, Iraq, Syria, and well into Turkey. All of that area was part of the Seleucid Empire. I think it even went a little bit further east at the height of its power and a little bit further north at the height of its power. And Turkey's possible. I'm assuming that when it talks about the king of the north, that it's talking about in the context of Daniel 12 at the end of the chapter, when it's talking about the king of the north, it's going to talk about some incarnation of the Seleucid kingdom. And whether that is rooted in Iran or Turkey or Iraq or Syria, I don't know the answer to that. It could be any of those. It seems like today that Iran would be the most likely suspect. Turkey would be a close second and a very close second. But it could be Syria. It could be Iraq. So it could be any of those. I just assume that it will arise out of the territory that the Seleucid Empire was located on. And for the most of its time, it was Iran, Iraq, and Syria. That's the only reason that I called it I referred to it as Iran and not Turkey, but Turkey is very possible. Okay. So chapter 12. Chapter 12 is the third chapter that talks about Daniel's third vision. It started in chapter 10. Chapter 10 kind of set the scene. It was after 3 weeks of fasting for the people of Israel that Daniel received this vision. And at the beginning of the vision, he sees this godlike figure dressed in linen. And so he appears to be a Messiah, or Messiah-like figure, a priest. He's a godlike priest. And I assume that's the Messiah. Then Daniel goes to sleep and is raised up. And I'm assuming that this is a different angelic being that raises him up. It's not impossible that it's the same man dressed in linen, but it seems like the choreography works better if it's another figure. And in these visions, it's Gabriel that's been Daniel's guide through these visions. So I'm assuming that this is Gabriel that raises him up and then describes to him this ongoing conflict that's happening in the heavenlies between the prince of Persia and the archangels of God. Then chapter 11 describes coming events with respect to an ongoing conflict that will develop between the two of the Hellenistic kingdoms, the one in the north, the Seleucid Empire, and the one in the south, the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. An ongoing conflict develops between these Hellenistic countries. And the vision is particularly interested in this particular conflict because Israel is strapped right in between them and gets hammered by both sides. And so the vision focuses on the conflict between these two kingdoms hitting Israel, affecting Israel, and culminating in persecution of the believers in Israel by the Seleucid king Antiochus IV. But then it talks about, then there's this section that I referred to in the answer to the first question that is transitional, talking about persecution in general. And then it starts talking about the king of the north again. But what is said in this last section, verses 40 through the end of the chapter, no one argues that Antiochus IV fulfilled that. He didn't do anything like those, the things that are described there. So some commentators say, well, at this point, the book of Daniel just gets the predictions wrong. The book of Daniel was, for most of them, they would assume that the book of Daniel was written in 170 or so, 169. And all of the events that it describes happened prior to that, up until you get to verse 40. So they assume that it was written after those things already happened. And then it goes on to predict some things, and it gets those all wrong. And that's 40 through whatever. My perspective is, no, it was written back closer to the time of Daniel. These were true predictions of things to come a couple hundred years into the future. They did happen. We have this transitional section that talks about generic persecutions that would occur, and then it starts talking about the end. And the reason that we don't have historical events that correspond to that section is because what's described there has not yet happened. Okay, but as it describes, this Antiochus-like persecutor in the last few verses of chapter 12, at the height of his power, is going to hear rumors. It's going to scare him. And just like Antiochus, the fourth, who went down to Egypt, was scared away from Egypt by the Romans, came back, was frustrated because he wasn't able to take Egypt, and he persecuted the Jews. In this case, this Antiochus-like persecutor is going to be frustrated hearing the news from the east and the north, and he's going to settle down and start persecuting the Jews. I was just thinking, there are real similarities between what's described here and Hitler, insofar as Hitler didn't start seriously going about exterminating the Jews until things were starting to turn on the battlefield against Germany. And if my recollection is correct, then that would be another instance where a big persecutor becomes frustrated in having his plans fulfilled and takes out that frustration on the Jewish people and persecutes them mercilessly. Okay, so that's after having talked about this Antiochus-like persecutor, then it shifts into chapter 12. So chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found in the book, will be delivered. So at that time, I assume, is talking about the great distress that was just talked about at the end of chapter 11. It's under this Antiochus-like persecutor at the end of time, at the end of history. And when the persecution that he conducts is at its height, and this, I'm assuming this is persecution primarily in Israel, when this is at its height, that's when Michael will arise. And Michael is the defender of Israel and the people of Israel. Michael will rise up and act on behalf of his people. It says that there will be a time of distress such as has not happened from the beginning of nations until then. So this is going to be persecution at its greatest, the greatest that's ever been seen. And it says, it's interesting that it says, from the beginning of, my translation has nations as the NIV. The word there is goy, from the beginning of goy. So the beginning of nation, the beginning of ethnicity or nationhood or whatever, I suspect is the idea. So it kind of hints at the beginning of people becoming social units, big social units, kind of hinting at empire. But at that time, your people will be delivered. So Michael is going to come in when things are at their worst, and he is going to deliver his people, the Jews, from this persecution. It says, everyone whose name is found written in the book. So the way that Daniel's people are being described here as people whose names are written in the book. I assume that's the book of life. So it's those who are true believers. Okay. Next section, verses 2-4. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge. So many will awaken from the grave, I assume this is talking about the resurrection of the dead at the end of time, at the end of history. And some will rise to enjoy eternal life. And those are the wise. Those are the ones who have embraced the truth. And those are the ones who have led many to righteousness. And who do lead many to righteousness. And these will rise to great glory. Others will rise to, how's it describe it? Shame, to shame and everlasting contempt. I assume that's the eternal damnation that the non-wise will arise to. Daniel's told to seal up the words of the scroll. Now, is the scroll just this vision, or is the whole book of Daniel? I don't know. People have argued both ways. My suspicion is that it's the whole book of Daniel, the whole composition that we've been studying, but I don't know that for sure. And seal it. And some people have taken that to mean to seal it, that is to hide it away. But the argument has been made, and I think it makes the most sense, that it doesn't mean hide it away. It means to preserve it, to seal it in the sense of to preserve it and keep it. Because this is going to serve a very important function, especially when we get to the end of history. And then it says, people will look everywhere for knowledge. I'm assuming that the kind of knowledge that's being talked about here in this context is knowledge about how do we make sense of life? What is going on in the world? And that question gets particularly acute at the end of history, but it's not only at the end of history that question is acute. But that is a question that has plagued mankind forever, trying to sort out meaning of life. Why are we here? And what's this all for? And I think that's suggesting that this book makes an important contribution to understanding the answer to that question for anybody who cares, for anybody who's willing to study it. Verses 5-6. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. One of them said to the man clothed in linen, who is above the waters of the river, how long will it be before these astonishing things are fulfilled? Now, as I have mentioned before, I think that the choreography that's going on between these angelic beings and Daniel is significant. I just am not sure exactly what it's signifying, what's going on here. So this is just my best guess at this point. In chapter 10, we are introduced to this man in linen, this godlike being, priestly being, probably the Messiah. And he reappears in these verses, standing, it says, above the waters. We'll come back to that. The other figure, presumably Daniel, as I mentioned, raised Daniel up. This was in chapter 10, raised him up and gave him the visions of the kings of the north and the south. This section then sees two others. That's what it calls them, two others. One is dressed in linen, so that's the Messiah figure on one side of the river, and another figure on the other side of the river. So I assume that's another angelic being. So we've got a total of three that we're working with. Now, when it talks about the Messiah-like figure, it says, who was above the waters of the river. Curiously, the word that's usually used for river in Hebrew is different from the one that occurs here. The one that's here is Ye'or, which is usually the word, the name that's used for the Nile. The Nile was the river. This word can be used to just mean the river, but it's not typically the word that's just used for a river. So it's curious that that's the word that would be used in this context. One commentator suggested that this is to hearken back to the Exodus, when God launched an attack against the gods of the Nile, of Egypt and the Nile, and that this is an allusion to that, and the fact that God brought the people of Israel out of Egypt in spite of the Egyptian gods. Possibly, I don't know what else to do with this phrase, who was above the waters of the river. That's repeated two times. I'm confident significant. The other one then asks the Messiah, how long until these things are fulfilled? The question is, what are these things? Is it talking about all that was in the vision in chapter 11? Or is it just talking about this end section where the persecution is particularly acute? I think it's probably the latter, that it's when he's talking about how long will the persecution be that's at the end. That seems to be all that's talked about as we proceed on, and that seems to be the question that was on their minds throughout, and I'll look at that in just a second. The man clothed, this is verse 7, the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river lifted his right hand and his left hand towards heaven. And I heard him swear by him who lives forever, saying, it will be for a time, times, and half a time, when the power of the holy people has been finally broken, all these things will be completed. So it's the godlike, priest-like figure that gives a response, and he gives a response by raising both arms to make an oath. And in he's going to swear by the one who lives forever. Presumably we're talking about God, Yahweh here. That he takes an oath to certify his answer. And his time his response is that enigmatic response for a time, times, and that's a dual form. Hebrew has a single form, singular form, a dual, and a plural. So they can either indicate one, two, or more than two by the form, by the ending on the word. And this has the dual form, suggesting two. So for a time, two times, and half a time. This is the fourth time that we have heard a figure given describing how long in the book of Daniel, since started with chapter 7. In chapter 7, in the vision of the four beasts, no one asked the question, but in Daniel 7:25, with respect to the Antichrist, it says, he will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. So the answer tells us how long the saints will be persecuted in the final persecution. And we get this enigmatic answer, time, times, and half a time. The same thing that we see in this chapter 12. And presumably that meant three and a half somethings. And usually years is the unit that's plugged in there, 3.5 years. We also saw the time referred to in chapter 8 in the vision of the ram and the goat. In Daniel 8, 13, it says, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot. Now, this one was with respect to the small horn of the goat. And I interpreted this to be about Antiochus IV. And the question that's asked is, how long will the temple be defiled, essentially? And the answer was 2,300 evening mornings. Again, an enigmatic answer. It's not clear what an evening morning is. But generally what people do is take that to mean the evening and morning sacrifices. And therefore, an evening morning, there would be an evening sacrifice and a morning sacrifice for each day. So you divide that number by two and it comes out to 1,150 days. And if you figure out, if you divide that by 360 or 365, depending on which one you want to use for years, it works out to about 3.2 years. So that's similar to 3.5. Then, in answer to Daniel's prayer in chapter 9, Daniel 9:27, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1/7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing, my translation is, of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Again, no one asked the question how long, but the period of time was simply offered. And it is, there are multiple times that are being given here, but the last period of time, the last seven, is divided in half, and a half of seven is 3.5 years. Then we have this passage. And so all of these are responding to the question, how long will the persecution last? In all of them, from 8, except for 8:13, which I think is talking about Antiochus IV, all the other three are talking about the persecution at the end. And in each case, the answer appears to be about 3.5. By the way, the time that Antiochus's persecution lasted is not too far off of that, if the dividing of the evening mornings into two to be the number of days is sound. So I think that that's the period of time that's being described here again and again enigmatically. It also says, when the power of the holy people has finally been broken. I assume that what this is talking about is their power in rebellion against God. That this is the time in which the rebelliousness of the people of Israel will finally be broken, and they will turn to God en masse. Verses 8 through 12. I heard, but I did not understand. So I ask. It's a clever, he doesn't understand what's going on, so he shifts and asks a different question. So I ask, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. So the question, the answer before was too enigmatic for Daniel to understand. So he switches. He asks a different question. It's related, but it's not the same question. And his question is, what will be the result? What will be the outcome of this? And I think what he's getting at is why? What is the purpose for this? Why do this? Why put my people through this? And the Messiah responds to Daniel, essentially saying, time's up. I'm done answering questions. Go on your way. The message is sealed, is protected until the end. But then he goes on and answers both questions, which is interesting. Before Daniel actually goes on his way, he gets responses to both questions, both the one that Daniel asked and the one that he didn't understand the answer to. So the question of why. The answer that's given is because it will purify many. That all those who embrace the truth will understand what is happening and why it is happening, and they will be purified by the experience. It will not, however, benefit the wicked. The wicked will just keep being wicked. That's what the wicked do. Then he responds to the wind. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up. So that's when this clock starts ticking on the time period that he's going to describe. I've never really decided whether the Bible teaches that the third temple will be built, but this passage causes me to suspect that there will be a third temple. It's talking about daily sacrifices. If we take that literally, it's possible that that's figurative language. But if it's literal, then they have to be recommenced. And in order for them to be recommenced, I assume that the temple has to be built. So if that's true, then the temple would be built sometime before the king of the north takes Jerusalem. And not only will the temple be rebuilt, but the sacrifices will be started again. And the king of the north then will stop those sacrifices and set up the abomination of desolation. And I don't know what that is. But notice that, again, this is a reiteration of what Antiochus IV did. The king of the north, this persecutor at the end, when things get worse than they've ever been, is going to follow in the footsteps of Antiochus IV. So that will start the clock. What will end the clock is, it just says, till the end. I assume the end is when Jesus comes back. But then it presents us with numbers that present a mathematical puzzle. I have never used a calculator more in studying a biblical passage than I have in the book of Daniel. I've punched in all these numbers and divided them by all kinds of numbers, mostly 7 and 70 and et cetera, and 360 and et cetera. And I haven't solved it. The number that's used is 1,290 days. If you divide that by 360, which, as I understand it, was the length of year that was used in the Jewish calendar, that would be 3.58 years. If you divide it by 365, which is our solar calendar, it comes out to 3.53 years. So in either case, it's really close to 3.5. Then it says Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. I have no idea what that means. Why this larger number? It's larger by 45 days, which is a month and a half. Why this additional month and a half? I do not know. Last verse of the chapter. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. So now go your way. Don't worry about it. Continue as you were until you die. And then at the end of days, and so presumably that's when the 1,335 days is over. I assume that's the case, the bigger of the two numbers. When those days are over, you will rise. So resurrection, I assume, and you will get your inheritance. And there I think it's talking about the eternal inheritance. And typically you would expect in the Old Testament, when it's talking about your inheritance, it would be talking about the lands that were given to your tribe, clan, and to your family personally. But here I think it means that more kind of symbolically, that is your eternal inheritance. Okay. I think that's all I was going to say about chapter 12. So that's the end of Daniel. Now I'm going to go through the heart of what I think it's talking about in the book of Daniel as a whole. And I said at the very beginning in the introduction that the book of Daniel is about empire. I still think that's true. And so let me talk a little bit about empire and what we do in the midst of empire. And those will be my concluding comments. What is empire? The way I'm using the term, empire is the natural contrivance of sinful man to cope with our fears for our safety and comfort. That it is our natural tendency as human, sinful human beings to come together and try to jointly provide for our own safety and security. And so we come together and we pool all of our resources, both our labor, our mental resources, etc., our wealth, all of that. We pool those things in order to provide for the safety of all of us. And that becomes the basis of community. There is nothing inherently wrong with pooling resources to take care of ourselves. The problem is, given the fact that we are sinners, and given the fact that we are disinclined to trust God, what we are inclined to do is to then see that community that we form as the source of our safety and security instead of God, in place of God. And that is inherently wrong. So empire is sinful man's alternative to God. The empire becomes our God. The empire becomes our savior. It's essentially idolatry. And the temptation for every individual to give in to this kind of idolatry can increase depending on the circumstances. Empire, over time, as we experience empire, we become more comfortable with the notion that it will take care of us. And as the community provides more and more of our, for more and more of our needs, we become more comfortable with the idea that the community takes care of us. And as society becomes more artificial, the tendency for us to see society as the thing that takes care of us becomes greater. Let me explain that one a little bit more. I don't think I talked about this previous in this session in the series. It's, some of you have probably heard me talk about this in other contexts, but it was striking to me in studying Russian history that there's this period of time of rapid industrialization. When before industrialization starts in Russia, it's 90% peasants who are working farms, most of them working farms for lords who own the land, and the peasants are just working the land like slaves. But Russia realized that they needed to go through, they need to industrialize extremely quickly, because in some wars, they realized that technology was playing a bigger and bigger role in warfare. And in order for Russia to compete technologically, they had to start becoming industrialized. And they had to do it very quickly, or Russia would cease to exist. So the Russian Tsars went through a really condensed form of industrialization, a process that in England, for instance, took 200 years and was very disruptive to society. Russia was trying to do in 50 years and was even more traumatic, which eventually led to the Russian Revolution. But the thing that is relevant here is when you have these peasants who are working out in the farms come in and start working in the factories, their whole way of looking at the world changes. When they're on the farms, they are overwhelmingly religious. Religious and or superstitious. And I think that the reason is because on farms, it is clear that much of your well-being is out of the control of any human being. It's diseases, it's droughts, it's crop failure of any kind. Those are the most important things, important factors in your being able to stay alive. And as a result, people in agrarian settings are overwhelmingly religious. If you take those same people and put them in a factory, now all of a sudden, and it happens in a relatively short period of time, about one generation, and it can happen in less than that length of time, they begin to realize that the biggest forces in their lives are what other people do. At least that's the way it appears to them, that it's politics that matter. It's what market forces do with the price of whatever you're manufacturing. It's laws passed by the Tsar that affect your well-being. Minimum wage laws or whatever. Those are the kinds of things that are important to you. And it really appears as though the biggest factors that have a bearing on your well-being are in the hands of men. And as a result, people in that environment become atheists and they become politically active. So the artificiality of society can incline people more towards empire, accepting empire, idolizing empire, seeing empire as the thing that provides them safety and security and well-being. Okay, so that's what happens to individuals who are in empire, that there are, under certain circumstances, they are more and more inclined to invest their trust in empire. There's another dynamic at work, and that is, as empire grows, it attracts some ruthless people to power, to take advantage of the power that is accumulated in that empire. So, ruthless people seek to find ways to appropriate that power and benefit themselves and their families and friends. And the more wealth and control that members of society hand over to the community, the greater the community resources. And so ruthless people, they try to coax the members of the community into granting the community more control over more and more aspects of their lives, because that means there's more that they can siphon off for their own purposes. So they do that with trinkets, bling bling, with goodies. In the Roman period, it was bread and circuses that were used to gain greater and greater control over the members of the community. So the more control that the empire develops, the more subservient the population. And the end is enslavement to the thing that was supposed to make them safe and secure. The irony that's built into empire. Empire is essentially and necessarily hostile to God. In order to be as powerful as possible, empire needs the absolute commitment of everyone. That's its goal. That's what it shoots for. It has not been always possible. There hasn't been the technological means to make everybody 100% committed to the community. But to the extent that it can be accomplished, empire has always sought that goal. So ruthless people within empire has always sought that. And God is a rival commitment and therefore cannot be tolerated. Furthermore, God is committed to the destruction of empire, and I think ruthless people ultimately know that that's true. Not only ruthless people, but I think people in general ultimately know that that's true. So from time to time, empire manifests its hostility to God with persecution of God's people. God, as Daniel assures us, God will at some point in time completely destroy empire. He's going to allow empire to grow and reach its telos, its natural end, its biggest and baddest, the apogee of its bigness and badness. And so we're going to see human wickedness written in huge letters for all to see. It's going to be human sinfulness writ large. No one will be able to avert their eyes and not see it. It's going to be clear to everyone. This is what is in the hearts of human beings. This is what man is capable of. Once it has reached its telos, God is going to completely destroy it, and it will never be resurrected. And God's people, the wise, will be freed from death and empire forever. We will be saved once and for all. And God is going to replace empire with the kingdom of God, which is eternal, provides absolute safety and security, and provides freedom from sin and death. And one of the things that's emphasized both in Daniel and in Revelation is it is multinational, multi-ethnic. Just as empire saw itself, its goal was to be multinational and multi-ethnic, the kingdom of God will be multinational, multi-ethnic. And it will be so in a genuinely beautiful way. Kyle summarizes the book of Daniel with these sentences. He says, "Accordingly, the revolution has this as its object, to show how the heathen world kingdoms shall not attain to an enduring stability, and by their persecution of the people of God, shall only accomplish their purification and bring on the end in which, through their destruction, the people of God shall be delivered from all oppression and be transfigured." So this is the truth. This is the true narrative. I use the term narratives in my introduction. This is the true narrative. This is the way things really are. Why is it important for us to know this? Why is the book of Daniel so important? We need to be protected from the seduction of culture. I think we underestimate how seductive culture is. Those who firmly believe this narrative will be invulnerable to empire. Empire will have no leverage over such people. That is, people who believe the gospel. And such people will undermine empire. Empire, on the other hand, is constantly trying to get us to fall for alternative narratives. Culture bombards us with messages designed to dissuade us of the gospel, of the true narrative, and to encourage us to believe a different narrative. And this pressure is hard to resist. To protect us in times of persecution, we need to keep the contents of the book of Daniel in mind. This is really the greater concern of the book of Daniel, is what do we need to be doing in times of persecution? And in particular, in the end, when the persecution is the most severe, the risks will be the greatest at that time. The most believers will lose their lives at that time. And it is going to look like God is losing badly. And as a result, believers' faith will be tested to the utmost at that time. And the question that will be raised, and this is true of any persecution, but especially at the end, is, will you witness to the truth of the gospel, even if it costs you your life? And this is clearly what we see in Revelation as well. And in some sense, every witness to the truth of the gospel is another nail in the coffin of empire. Anyone, any believer who refuses to bow his or her knee to empire is another nail in the coffin of empire. It's another victory for God and the Messiah. How do we then live? What we see from the book of Daniel is that for most times and places, we are called to live as a part of the society in which we find ourselves. And that's what we see Daniel doing. And that's what Jeremiah said that the people of the exiles in Babylon were supposed to do. The peace that an empire provides is a gift from God. It does provide a certain amount of order, a certain amount of safety, and a certain amount of protection. And that's a gift from God. So Daniel was able to live and operate within that community, within that context. Not without troubles, not without dangers, but he was able to live and able to negotiate those problems. But don't sacrifice your principles. That is, your God-given principles. And Daniel and his friends were examples of the integrity that it's necessary in order to live in the midst of empire. However, and so in most times, in most places, we live within that context as believers. But it is interesting to me that there are at least three times that I'm aware of where we are called to get out of Babylon, at least once in Revelation, a couple times in Jeremiah. And why? Well, we're told to get out of Babylon for a couple of reasons. One is to avoid the judgment that will befall Babylon. And secondly, to avoid the cultural influence and the temptations and the pressures that come with empire. How do we get out of Babylon? I think for the most part, there are lots of ways to get out of Babylon. Socially, to remove ourselves culturally from Babylon. Technologically, there may be ways technologically we can remove ourselves from Babylon. Physically, it's possible moving from one place to another at least helps with respect to getting out of Babylon. My suspicion is that when we are enjoined to get out of Babylon, what it is primarily talking about is a spiritual separation, but it could also include these other kinds of separation, and that it will depend on anyone's circumstances as to what shape that getting out of Babylon will take. But what is critical is that there be that spiritual departure from Babylon, where we hold firmly to the true narrative and we carefully avoid being seduced by the culture that we're in. As I was writing up my notes for the conclusion here, I was thinking about the last few years when I've been studying prophetic works intensively. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and I've looked at Revelation and others. And I have found it, as I've mentioned before, they are extremely difficult and there is much that I still do not understand. However, I have enjoyed reading them immensely, and it is not uncommon for me to read a section and then just stare out the window and think about what I just read and find it very helpful. As I've read through the prophets, I've benefited greatly from some of the commentaries that have shed light on what's going on in the books that I would not otherwise have known. There are a lot of people who have spent a lot of time looking at these books, and some of what they've observed is not helpful, but other things that they've observed is very helpful. So there are certain commentaries that I have found extremely helpful, And they provided both background information and observations that have helped me make better sense of the commentaries. But apart from that, the commentaries, the prophecies are full of passages that are clearly understandable, that are talking about righteousness, that are talking about judgment, that are talking about various aspects of the true narrative. And the future that awaits the righteousness is another big theme in the prophets. Those are all extremely helpful. And what I have come to see is that the prophets are like chiropractic for the soul. That as you read through some of these passages and you think about it, it realigns your soul in conformity with the true narrative, with truth. And I have found that extremely beneficial. It is so easy when we are living our lives in a world that is extremely confused, and in a world in which we're bombarded with all kinds of notions, it's extremely easy for our soul to get out of alignment. And the chiropractic for the soul is very valuable. I recommend it very highly. Okay, I received another question, this one from Margaret, this morning. And so I thought I would respond to that, and then I'll take other questions. The question that Margaret sent was, the answer may be necessarily speculative, but why do you suppose Yahweh sends prophecy in so many different forms? Some is very specific. For example, Isaiah mentions Cyrus by name, the 70 years of Babylonian captivity. Some reference a type, for example, Elijah returning, Emmanuel. Some are highly symbolic, for example, the beast with horns, statue with gold head and clay feet, the many, many Tekel Upharsin thing where there's wordplay and weird language. Some possibly compress long time periods together. Some have angels helping with interpretation. So you've got all these different elements to the various prophetic works, all presenting prophecy in a different way. Why is that? And my short answer is, I don't know. I do know that, although, as I have mentioned, I am surprised at how little of the prophetic works deals with specific, unique prediction. But those specific, unique predictions are extremely important, because when those come to pass, it gives you much more confidence in those that are less specific and unique. So the fact that it is sprinkled with some of those kinds of predictions is extremely important. Another thing that's important is the short-term prophecies. Some of the prophecies, and in fact, what I've argued is, I think virtually all prophecy has its eye on the end. In some way, what it's talking about is related to the end. And some of it is exclusively related to the end. But it oftentimes talks about short-term events, predictions of what will happen in the short term. And although those are also looking towards the end, those short-term predictions, when they come true, that becomes very significant for the long-term predictions. And again, it's accrediting. It gives you confidence that the long-term predictions are also true. The prophetic works and the various prophecies, they constitute a huge puzzle that has to be put together. And like I say, it's primarily about the end, because the end is going to bring together a lot of the themes that weave their way through history and through the other prophetic passages. So you need to know the Bible as a whole, and you need to know the story that God is telling. But because it's this huge puzzle, it's like at Christmas time, our family has had a tradition of buying a jigsaw puzzle and working on it. We start working on it after Thanksgiving. And whenever we're sitting around talking or watching TV or whatever, people contribute to finding pieces and where they go. Understanding the prophetic picture, I think, ends up being a lot like those jigsaw puzzles. And lots of different people are able to contribute different pieces to that puzzle. And some people are able to process one kind of prophetic statement better than other people, but somebody else seems to work better in a different prophetic context. So it takes lots of different people looking at things from lots of different angles to put those pieces together before the whole picture emerges. So it seems to me that the prophetic works are the kind of thing that it really takes a lot of people working on to put it all together and to make sense of it. And furthermore, the Bible as a whole, but prophecy, it fits into this pattern as well. The Bible yields up its treasures to those who most want to know. A quick read won't do it. It has to be read, it has to be thought about, it has to be processed, and it has to be lived out. That's the kind of person that is best equipped to understand what the Bible's talking about. Okay, so that's the answer that I would give to Margaret's question that she sent to me. Now I see lots of questions. Stefan and Karina, I am unclear about why Antiochus the IV doesn't fulfill verses 11:40 through 45. Can you explain it again? There are some specific things that are said in that section. In that section, it says that the king of the north is going to sweep down, conquer Israel and Elam and etc., go down and conquer Egypt and Libya and Somalia, present day areas, then come back to Israel and pitch his tent between the two seas, and then he's going to hear this rumor here from the east and from the north, and then he's going to persecute the people, and then he's going to pass away, and he's going to disappear. There is no one that I have found who has argued that any of that fits Antiochus. Antiochus, after he starts the persecution of the Jews in Jerusalem, from what we know in history, he takes off to the north and starts fighting against the Parthians, I believe it is, and he dies up there. I don't remember if he dies in combat or if he just gets sick and dies, but he dies up there. He doesn't come back to Israel again at all. He doesn't go to Egypt again. So none of that fits, and I have not seen anyone who argues that Antiochus the IV fits into those verses. Robbie says, a comment compared Daniel 12:7 with Revelation 10, especially 10:5 through 7. Okay, and then she goes on. Then the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted up his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things in it. And then she continues, who created heaven and the things in it, that there will be delay no longer, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel when it is about to sound. Continued, then the mystery of God is finished, as he predicted to his servants, the prophets. Continued. Both figures are set apart by appearance. Both raise their arms to swear by God. Both are dealing with the question of time. Okay. I don't remember what's going on in Revelation 10. So I would have to go back and look at it. But it would not surprise me at all that there is some correlation between the two passages. And it wouldn't surprise me if there is a figure that is performing the same service in both passages. But I would have to go back and remind myself of what's going on in Revelation 10. But I won't do that right now. Margaret says, the pattern time, two times and half a time, is the same numerically as many, many tekel upharsin. Yes? If so, significance. What do you mean by pattern? If you mean three elements, if you mean three elements, that I could see where that could be argued. And significance, I don't know. I have really been stymied trying to figure out why the answer is given in the form time, two times, and half a time. If what is meant is three and a half, why not say three and a half? So something's going on there. There's some reason it's broken up into three parts. I don't know what that is. Is it the same reason why many, many tekel upharsin is in three parts? I don't know. Sam says, if I understand it correctly, the Jews were told that they would go to Babylon and stay 70 years and then come home. It was really 72 years. Perhaps Nehemiah got really sad because the fourfold time was up. It looks to me that prophetic time is not timed in correct German fashion. Okay. By my calculation, I mean, it depends. When it says that they will be in Babylon for 70 years, when you start the clock and when you stop the clock. It appears to me that the best marker for when to start and stop the clock is when are the temple vessels in Babylon. And if that's the clock that you're going to use, then it is a year or two short of 70 years, as best I can figure it with my calculator. And I think that is why you say perhaps Nehemiah got that really sad. Why Nehemiah got really sad? Did you mean Nehemiah or did you mean Daniel? I think that's why Daniel, it wasn't that it was overtime. Daniel got really sad because the 68 or 69 years had passed. Jews were returned back to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And two or three years after they're back there, it becomes clear that the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple is not going to happen anytime soon because the political forces that be are such that it's just not going to happen soon. So if you meant perhaps that's why Daniel got really sad, I think it's true. He got sad because things were not happening the way that he had expected them to happen. And I think it is true, the prophetic time is not timed in correct German fashion. That is, if what you mean is to the minute, that prophetic time is oftentimes an approximation. Okay. So Margaret wrote saying 1:2.5. Didn't you say that many, et cetera, referred to 1:2.5? Okay, I understand. The many, many Tekelu Farsin, what I was trying to do was come up with English words that were both measurements and verbs. So I can't remember what quarter, I said quarter, half, I can't remember. But I was just trying to imitate that. Many, many Tekelu Farsin does not mean time, times, and half. Time, 1, 2.5. I can't remember exactly what the numbers, I don't think. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are. But I'd have to go back and look at that. And I will do so. Are there any other questions? Especially ones I can answer. Okay. Well, that brings us to an end. I really enjoyed working through this book. I found it very interesting. I spent a lot of time. I'm not the most efficient studier, but I spent a lot of time on it. I understand Daniel much better than I did when we started this series. And I had spent a lot of time before I even started. So this has been wonderful for me. I hope that it has been beneficial for you. Thank you for your attention. And we'll try something else in the future, some other book in the future. Thank you. Goodbye.